Last week, we began our study of the Sermon on the Mount with an introduction. And really, we spent all of our time on verse 1 and some of the verses that surround it and some of the verses that it connects to. We talked about the gospel of the kingdom. We talked about the mountain. And we talked about the disciples. And this week, we will begin to explore the text itself with what is certainly the most well-known section of the sermon, and the section that serves as its foundation. It's a section that is known as the Beatitudes. So I'd like to begin just by reading Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 12. It says, "Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, 'Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you.'" It's a beautiful section of text. And last week, we noticed the two verses that bookend the section of the sermon, the section of Matthew that contains the Sermon on the Mount. That's Matthew chapter 4 and verse 23 and Matthew 9 and verse 35. And both of them talk about how Jesus was proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and he was teaching in their synagogues. And so that tells us that Jesus' ministry was filled with proclaiming and teaching. Or in other words, he is announcing and giving instruction. And that's true right here at the very beginning with this section that we call the Beatitudes. He is making announcements and giving instruction. He's describing the essential qualities of people who will respond to the gospel. And so the announcement is that against all expectation, these are the people who will be truly blessed. And the instruction is that if you want to be blessed, then you must become like them. This is the good soil that Jesus describes in the parable of the sower. These are the kind of people who will receive the word and understand it and bear fruit. These are the ones to whom the kingdom of heaven belongs. And there are eight statements here that are given. And you'll notice that each statement begins with the same word, and that's the word blessed, or if you prefer the old-fashioned way to say it with two syllables, blessed. Jesus is pronouncing that these are the blessed people, and that is where we get this term beatitude. It comes from the Latin word that means blessedness. And so that begs the question, what does it mean to be blessed? Well, it's a word that describes a state of spiritual well-being and prosperity. It's related to the Hebrew word that is translated blessed in places like Psalm 1, where it talks about the righteous man who is blessed. And some versions translate that word happy. In fact, when the Queen of Sheba comes and sees Solomon's servants and she says, "Happy are your servants," she's using that word that can be translated blessed. And so probably the simplest synonym or definition that we might say for the word blessed is the word happy. And I know that some of you will be quick to say, "Oh no, it means much more than that." And you're right, it does. But but it certainly doesn't mean less. These are those who are truly happy. These are those who have a deep and abiding spiritual well-being and prosperity. A word that I like to think of is the word fulfilled. Jesus is describing the kind of people who will actually find fulfillment. And fulfillment is really what everybody is after. Everybody wants to have comfort and security and satisfaction. Everybody wants to be loved and accepted. Everybody wants fulfillment. And here Jesus tells us the kind of people who will actually find it. And his position is that true fulfillment can only be found in the kingdom of heaven. You might notice that the Beatitudes begin and end the same way. The first one says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And then the last one says, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Verses 11 and 12 are really just an expansion of that last statement in verse 10. And so that suggests that these qualities are really all one unit. It's sort of like the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5. Paul is not describing the fruits of the Spirit, plural. He's describing the fruit of the Spirit, singular. He's talking about what the Spirit produces in someone's life from 9 different angles. To perfect one of those qualities is to perfect them all, and to lack one of those qualities is to lack them all. It'd be very hard for somebody to really excel at love and joy and peace while being very deficient in patience, kindness, and goodness. And in the same way, the Beatitudes are not describing 8 different groups of people, but one group with 8 distinct qualities. And these are the essential qualities of those who will find fulfillment as citizens of the kingdom of heaven. And so what I'd like to do this afternoon is really very simple, is to just consider these statements one by one. The first is in verse 3 of Matthew 5. As Jesus begins, he says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Poverty of spirit describes the disposition of shameless humility. Shameless humility. It might help to think about the opposite for a second. Somebody who is rich in spirit, somebody who's really full of themselves, would be somebody who has a lot of confidence in themselves. They trust themselves for all of their needs. And a person like that doesn't really feel like they need God at all because they can count on themselves to take care of themselves. Someone who's rich in spirit lets his pride get in the way of seeing his true condition. He foolishly thinks that he can find fulfillment his own way. And so Jesus says the gospel is not for somebody like that. But now think about somebody else. Imagine somebody else comes to God and maybe they hear some things that are preached in sermons and they know some things about the Bible and the promises that God makes to his people. And they've sat back and they've thought about it for a little bit. And so they come to God and they say, "Okay, you know what? You've convinced me. You are offering a pretty good compensation package. I like what you're offering. Sign me up. I will offer my services." I see some of you shaking your heads because that's also not being spiritually poor. That's being spiritually middle class. Jesus is not talking about somebody who comes to God and says, "I will give you what I have." He's talking about somebody who comes to God and says, "I have nothing." He's describing people who are spiritual beggars. Somebody who comes to God realizing they have nothing to offer, nothing to bring. And so they acknowledge their total reliance on God's grace to have any blessing at all. And if you or I are going to be a part of the kingdom of heaven, that is where we must begin. It's realizing that we are spiritually destitute. We are poor. We have nothing to offer God. All we can do is ask him for his grace. It reminds me of the parable of the dishonest manager in Luke chapter 16. There's a story there that Jesus tells about a man who was dishonest in managing his accounts. And as happens many times, his misdeeds catch up to him. The master finds out. And that manager is driven to the point of despair. He says to himself in verse 3, "What shall I do? I am not strong enough to dig, and I am too ashamed to beg." That was a man who was humbled, but he still wasn't poor in spirit. He knew that he wasn't strong enough to dig. He knew that he couldn't work himself out of his problem. He couldn't work hard enough to provide for himself. And the truth is, that's where all of us are spiritually. None of us can dig ourselves out of the cosmic pit that we've fallen into because of our own sins. But the poor in spirit are those who are not ashamed to beg. Those who come to God as beggars, those are the ones to whom the kingdom belongs. From there, Jesus says in the next verse, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." Now, you might have noticed that in the first beatitude, Jesus didn't merely say, "Blessed are the poor." He said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." He's talking about spiritual qualities here. And the same is true for this second statement. He's not merely talking about the unavoidable mourning that all of us face in life. You can't go through life without facing tragedy, hardship, disappointment, heartbreak. Everyone experiences those things. But Jesus is talking about those who choose to cry because they understand the problem of sin. He's talking about people who sense the terror of sin and are moved to grieve it. It doesn't take an expert to look around and see that humanity has problems. In fact, that is what much of philosophy and religion concerns itself with, is saying, what is it that's wrong with us? We look around and we see all kinds of terrible things that human beings are capable of. Sometimes people inflict pain and suffering on one another. Sometimes people inflict pain and suffering on themselves. But the blessing of comfort is only for those who are willing to see the real problem for what it is. Only those who can recognize the goodness of God will be able to diagnose the real problem of sin. And those are the ones who will seek out the cure. It reminds me of what Jesus said in Mark chapter 2, in verse 17. "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." And so what Jesus is teaching here is that for us to really find comfort, we first have to mourn the problem itself. We all have issues. We all have problems. But our problems are not merely psychological or social. The problem that we have at its core is sin. It's a violation of the will of God. And when we are moved to godly sorrow, that's when we'll repent, like 2 Corinthians 7 says. And so those who find comfort from sin are those with an awareness to mourn it. The third beatitude is, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." The definition of meekness would be gentleness, self-restraint, or strength under control. It's a word that's associated with lowliness, kindness, long-suffering, and forbearance. And Jesus says, these are the kind of people who will inherit the earth. I think that if somebody was listening to this sermon with a very critical ear, this might be the point where somebody would first say, wait a second, that doesn't sound right. Can you think of anything more ridiculous than this? The meek are the ones who inherit the earth. I wonder if Peter had to put his hand on his mouth at this point. Because this is the kind of thing that somebody might raise their hand and say, wait a second, Jesus, that's just not the way the world works. Might makes right. It's survival of the fittest. From the dawn of time, the people with the most money and power and control and land have been the ones who have been the strongest and have taken those things from others. But remember, Jesus is describing a kingdom that's not filled with people who have swords and spears, but people who have beat their swords and spears into plowshares and pruning hooks. It's a kingdom that conquers the world, not by physical warfare, not by conquering others or oppressing others, but through spiritual means. Jesus shows us a better way. He talks about people who are not trying to elevate themselves by tearing others down. People who abandon that way of thinking. People who learn to count others as more significant than themselves. And though it might not look like this is true for right now, Jesus' point is, if you wait long enough, you'll see that this is true. Earlier, Scott read for us from Psalm 37, and I'd like to flip back there for just a moment. That's the point of this psalm. Scott read verses 3 through 11, and I'd like for us to focus on verses 7 through 11. Psalm 37 in verse 7 says, "Be still before the Lord, and wait patiently for him. Fret not yourself over the one who prospers in his way, over the man who carries out evil devices. Refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not yourself, it tends only to evil. For the evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord shall inherit the land. In just a little while, the wicked will be no more. Though you look carefully at his place, he will not be there. But the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace." What David was able to observe way back in Psalm 37 is that the inheritance of the wicked is fleeting. Sure, there are times when it looks like the wicked prosper, and for much of human history, it's those who have been the most ruthless who have been the most successful. But Jesus says, those who truly get the best out of life are those who have their strength under control. Those who put others before themselves. And I'll suggest that there's a way that this is true in this life and a way that it's true in the life to come. That when we learn to stop taking for ourselves, when we learn to stop competing against other people, when we learn to live in a way where we have others in mind and not ourselves, we learn what life is really all about. We delight in peace. We're free from fretting because of the wickedness of evildoers. We get the best out of life and the best out of the land. But Jesus says, in the end, these are the people to whom the world belongs. The meek set their sights on heaven, and they get the earth thrown in. Those who set their sights on the earth will ultimately miss out on both. The fourth beatitude says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied." The fourth beatitude is about appetite. And I want you to notice that Jesus doesn't say, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for blessedness." We already established earlier that that's really kind of what everybody hungers and thirsts for. Everybody wants fulfillment. Everybody wants peace and safety and security. Everybody wants to be happy. But the thing about happiness is that happiness is always a byproduct. It's not something that you can pursue and obtain directly. You know, the surest way to live a miserable, disappointing life is to dedicate your life to the pursuit of happiness. But the sooner that you learn to put others' welfare first, the sooner that you learn to live for something greater than yourself, the more quickly that you come to realize that you have a peace and a joy and a satisfaction that you never would have had otherwise. And Jesus is speaking to what our greatest need is. It's righteousness. It's to be right with God. It's to be in harmony with His will. It's to love what He loves. It's to be declared as His son and as His friend. And Jesus says, if that's what you want, then that is where you will find satisfaction. If you simply hunger and thirst for blessedness, you might try to satisfy yourself with all kinds of things that might seem to work for a short amount of time. You might try to satisfy yourself with materialism or with accomplishments or with pleasure. And Jesus is telling us that will never work. The writer of Ecclesiastes went to great pains to show us that that would never work. It's like drinking salt water. The more you drink, the thirstier you get. But again, this reminds me of an Old Testament verse. Back in Isaiah chapter 55, we see the invitation of God. Isaiah 55 and verse 1. Come, everyone who thirsts. Come to the waters, and he who has no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen diligently to me and eat what is good, and delight yourselves in rich food. Incline your ear and come to me. Hear that your soul may live, and I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David. God has always been pleading with His people that they would be able to see beyond their immediate desires, to see what their greatest need is. And so God is asking His people here in Isaiah the same thing that Jesus is asking us to think about today. Why do you spend your money on that which does not satisfy? Why do you keep trying to find satisfaction in that which will never produce it? Listen to me. Incline your ear. Come to me. Hear that your soul may live. And I will make with you an everlasting covenant. That's where righteousness can be found. It's in a covenant relationship with God. And so Jesus tells us satisfaction will only be found by people who have an appetite for what everyone needs the most. The fifth beatitude. It says, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. That's an interesting one. There's a little bit of a cyclical nature to that. Jesus says that the ones who receive mercy will be the ones who show mercy. Why do you think that is? Well, I think it's because the only ones who receive mercy from God are the ones who realize how much they need it. And the ones who realize how much they need it will be the ones most willing to give it to others. Isn't that the point of the unforgiving servant parable in Matthew 18? Jesus told a parable there about a man who owed his master an extraordinary debt, a debt he could never repay, 10,000 talents, and his master forgave him. But then that same servant went out and he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii, which admittedly is a sizable sum, but much, much smaller than what that servant had just been forgiven of. And remember, he seized him and he choked him and he said, pay what you owe. And I want you to see the master's reaction to that in Matthew 18 and verse 31. When his fellow servants saw what had taken place, they were greatly distressed, and they went and reported to their master all that had taken place. Then his master summoned him and said to him, you wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me, and should not you have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had mercy on you? And in his anger, his master delivered him to the jailers until he should pay all his debt. So also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother from your heart. One unavoidable point in the Sermon on the Mount is that the way that we treat other people says a great deal about the way that we see ourselves. Those who are unmerciful ultimately are those who don't realize their own dependence on mercy. Those who are unmerciful have let pride get in, and they think of themselves as being more dependable, more faithful, more successful than they are. But the ones who sense their smallness in the presence of an almighty, holy God are the ones who also sense their dependence on mercy and are willing to grant mercy to others because they realize how much smaller that amount is that they must give to them. And so Jesus says, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy." The sixth beatitude says, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." The literal meaning of the word pure is single. And I think that we would understand that just from our own experiences in life. You know, if you think about something being pure, pure gold, pure water, pure milk, it means that there's no additives in it. It's only one thing. And so what Jesus is describing by purity of heart is really singleness of heart. He's describing blessings for those who are fully committed and fully sincere, not people who try to have one foot in the kingdom and the other foot in the world, but those who put their hand to the plow and refuse to look back. These are the people who will see God. And I think as we consider these statements in the Beatitudes, that all of them speak to blessings that we enjoy now and blessings that we look to in the future. The kingdom of heaven belongs to us now. The comfort belongs to us now. The earth, in a sense, belongs to us now. Satisfaction and mercy belongs to us now. And even here in verse 8, seeing God is a blessing that belongs to us now. As we come to God with a purity of heart, as we come to Him wanting to see Him as He is, what ends up happening is we begin to resemble the one that we worship. His qualities become our qualities. His nature becomes our nature. We become partakers of that divine nature ourselves. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 3 and verse 18 that when we behold the glory of the Lord, that we are transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. And so it is those with a single-minded devotion to seeing God who will see Him first in this life and then ultimately, finally, plainly, and completely in the life to come. The seventh beatitude is, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." Fundamentally, the gospel itself is a message of peace. And so the gospel of the kingdom is a proclamation of peace. In Ephesians chapter 6, when it talks about the armor of God, you might remember that in verse 15 it says, "And for shoes for your feet, that we should put on the readiness given by the gospel of peace." The gospel is a message of peace. It's about how we who were God's enemies can be called His friends and His children. And so the sons of God are those who take up the kingdom's mission as their own. Those who go out into the world seeking to make peace with other people, seeking to help other people have peace with God. Those who go to every nation making disciples and bringing them into this fellowship. And I'll suggest that if that is what our mission is, then it will also keep us from getting sucked into selfish arguments and disputes and disagreements that only cause heartache and division and problems. Really, what Jesus is talking about is sharing the gospel with people. It's about telling other people how they can have peace with God. But if that's really what our lives are devoted to, then we're going to avoid a lot of pain and disagreement and conflict that we might otherwise slip into. Because we understand what really matters. We understand that people are the prize. We understand that there is a worth and a value in others. And so rather than fighting with them, we want them to have peace with God and with us. And so the citizens of the kingdom of heaven work to make peace between people because of the deep and abiding peace that they themselves have with God. And then finally, the final beatitude comes as a bit of a surprise. Because Jesus concludes by saying, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And you might think, who on earth would persecute people like this? Jesus is describing what we all know people should be like. You read through this list and you think, this is exactly the kind of world that I want to live in. These are the people that I want to know. This is the kind of person that I want to be. Who would ever persecute people like that? Well, the world would. Because the world has fallen into the clutches of the evil one. Jesus says in verses 11 and 12, "Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Jesus says, if you're persecuted, you ought to take that as a good sign, because it means you don't belong here. That should be good news. And Jesus said about himself in John chapter 3, verses 19 and 20, "The light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed." See, Jesus' point is that there is a goodness in him that the world refuses to accept. There is a light in him that is incompatible with the darkness. There's an otherworldliness to him that this place will never accept. It hasn't accepted the prophets who were before him. And now Jesus is saying this as the ultimate prophet. And he says in John 15 and verse 20, "A servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you." And as we think about that, we think about how all of these qualities point us to him. Who is the one who humbled himself with poverty of spirit? Who is the one who mourned sin the greatest? Who is the one who is the meekest who ever lived? Who's the one who really understood the value of righteousness? The one who is merciful and pure in heart and the ultimate peacemaker. When we read the Sermon on the Mount and we read the Beatitudes, what we see is that Jesus is the very manifestation of the sermon. The Beatitudes point us to him. And so when we consider the outcome of Jesus' life, how he was beaten, rejected, crucified, it's a sobering reminder that if we follow him, that those are the kinds of things that we ought to expect. We live in a time and a place where we enjoy peace and prosperity and protection that many Christians throughout the ages have not experienced. We shouldn't pretend like our suffering is greater than it is. But if we ever begin to feel like we belong here, we ought to be alarmed. If we ever begin to think that this world feels like our home and we don't want to leave it, then maybe we're not as much like our Savior as we like to think. If the world doesn't reject us, it ought to concern us. Because those who have fellowship with Jesus on earth will also have fellowship with him in heaven. And with that, the Beatitudes are concluded. In these eight concise statements, we have a portrait of the citizens of the kingdom of heaven, painted by the King himself. Jesus is announcing that despite the way the world thinks and despite what you might come to expect, that these are the people who will be blessed. And he's also teaching that if we want to be blessed, this is what we must become. A question that sometimes I think people have when you read the Beatitudes is, wow, this is asking a lot from me. Does this mean that the gospel is only for people who have it all together? You know? If Jesus is saying this is the essential qualities of those who are in the kingdom of heaven, does that mean I've got to get myself fixed up? I've got to get myself together before I come to Christ? Is that the point? And the answer is no, not at all. The kingdom of heaven is not a kingdom for the deserving, but for the seeking. And so these are the qualities of people who will acknowledge that they can't fix themselves. People who realize deeply their own brokenness. People who come to God pleading with him because they realize he's the only answer. And people who see in Jesus the person that they want to become. And so Jesus says, these are the ones to whom the kingdom of heaven belongs. Those who worship the King are those who come to be made like him. Those who love Jesus come to resemble him. And it begins with this utter humility, this disposition of the heart that comes to him and says, I have no other answer than you. You have the words of eternal life. There might be somebody here this afternoon who wants to come to Jesus in that way. And if you come to him, asking and seeking and knocking, then he will open a door and give you a new life where you can begin this road of discipleship with him. If you want to make your life right with God, and if we can help you in some way, we want to invite you to let that be known. You can come to the front while we stand and sing.